Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Susan Hirschfeld, and I'm assistant curator of the Guggenheim. And I am delighted to welcome you here this evening for the first of two lectures to be given in conjunction with the Nam Gabo retrospective currently on view in the museum. Before introducing tonight's speaker, I would, however, like to remind you that the second lecture to be given by Stephen Nash, who is the curator of the Gabo exhibition, will take place on Tuesday, April 15th. It gives me great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Charlotte Douglas, who is one of this country's leading scholars in the field of literature and art of the Russian avant-garde. Dr. Douglas received her MA and PhD from the University of Texas at Austin and wrote her dissertation on Malevich and the Origins of Suprematism, which was published in book form in 1980 as Swans of Other Worlds, Kazimir Malevich and the Origins of Abstraction in Russia. Dr. Douglas received numerous awards and fellowships, including both the Fulbright-Hays Full Award and Fulbright-Hays Research Fellowship in 1975. Dr. Douglas spent a year in 1975-76 lecturing at Moscow University in the Department of History of Russian and Soviet Art on a postdoctoral exchange program with the Soviet Union. Dr. Douglas has subsequently served on the faculties of Ohio State University, Hunter College, the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, New York University, and Yale University. From 1979 to 1985, Dr. Douglas was head of the Aesthetic Theory Section of the Institute of Modern Russian Culture at Austin, Texas, and most recently, she was editor and senior research scholar on the Khlebnikov Project, a multi-volume edition of the works of Velimir Khlebnikov, published last year by Harvard University Press. In addition to her teaching and active lecture schedule, Dr. Douglas has published extensively in art journals and exhibition catalogs. She has contributed much to our knowledge of Malevich, Matushin, and Popova, to name only a few, and has also furthered our understanding of modern Russian literature and art in general through her writing, teaching, and lecturing. Dr. Douglas is currently working on an essay entitled The Modernists and Mysticism in Russia, to be published in the Los Angeles County Museum of Art's forthcoming exhibition catalog on the spiritual in art, abstract painting from 1890 to 1986. Dr. Douglas delivered a fascinating paper on Pavel Filonov and the biological metaphor here in 1983, and we are delighted to welcome her back on this occasion. Tonight, Dr. Douglas will discuss Naum Gabo in relation to the Russian avant-garde and will examine his visions of a new world. Dr. Douglas, thank you.
Thank you, Susan, for that detailed introduction. Can you hear me? It is a curious fact that while Naum Gabo became a spokesman in Europe and the United States in the 1940s and 1950s for Russian constructivist art, we actually know very little about his life among the artists in Russia before he left there in 1922. Very little research has been done on Gabo in the Russian archives, either by Western or Russian scholars. Perhaps the present exhibition and the marvelous catalog which accompanies it by Stephen Nash, Jorn Mirkert, Colin Sanderson, and Christina Lauder will inspire further work in the museums and collections of the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, this evening, I shall try to locate Gabo within a general survey of the Russian avant-garde, to which he undoubtedly belongs, and to consider his work within the context of contemporaneous ideas and discussions. The beginning of Gabo's interest in art coincided with the rise of the avant-garde in Russia, and the development of his mature work took place in the context of revolutionary and civic-minded art. In fact, if one is to understand the nature of Gabo's work of the late teens and early 1920s, the function of his forms and origins of his vision, it is necessary to see them within the revolutionary context, in the remarkable art that grew up in the midst of material privations caused by two revolutions, a murderous civil war, a bruising rate of inflation, and a virtual stoppage of all commerce and transportation. At that moment, avant-garde artists in Russia were called upon to redefine the function of art, artists in Russia to establish a scientific basis for its development. By scientific, they meant the material and formal aspects of art, rather than the psychological material, an art which could evolve outside of the cultivated milieu of the upper classes of society, an art based on artistic and physical laws that could be learned in the laboratory and applied in the streets. Gabo's prior interests in art, science, engineering, and in the revolutionary social order all fell into place in Moscow in the days of revolutionary battles, when artists were suddenly as necessary to the political and social order as bread and trains. The unique features of Gabo's works make unique sense in this context. But before we get to 19, unique sense in this, briefly sketch in his background in a general way. Gabo came from a major industrial city, the city of Bryansk, southwest of Moscow, and northeast of Kiev. Born in 1890, the son of a metallurgist and manufacturer, Gabo came by his feeling for three-dimensional work naturally. His father owned a factory that built railroad equipment. Gabo has seems to have shared in the family interest in engineering, one of his brothers, as you know, was Antoine Pevsner, also an artist. Gabo changed his name when he began to make art from Pevsner to Gabo to distinguish himself from his brother. At one time, he even took courses in civil engineering. He developed anti-engineering sympathies while still a boy. He was a witness to local revolutionaries while still a 1905 and violent retaliation taken by the Tsar. 1905. He himself was arrested at the age of 17 for working in a literacy sponsored by the Social Democrats. He was sent to Munich sponsored by university education. He was there from 1910 to 1914. University education, studying medicine, the natural sciences, and some medicine, civil engineering, and art history. During that civil time, he returned often to his parents' home in Bryansk. Mid-1914, he and Antoine went to Norway, to Oslo, where they stayed working on their art until the first revolution occurred in Russia, March of 1917, when they felt it was then safe to return home. Gabo began to draw about 1908, when he was 18, and from his earliest surviving drawings, We have the lights down. This is a watercolor entitled Hamlet from 1912, titled Hamlet, which date between 1910 and 1912, this is a young girl. Gabo took as his models the faceted forms Gabo took as symbolist painter Mikhail Vrubel and the flat and decorative symbolist painter Henri Matisse. Both artists were well known and had had enthusiastic followers in Russia. Gabo probably saw the work of Boers in Russia, homes of the Moscow collectors Morozov and Shukin, homes On your right is Vrubel's Demon Seated from 1890.
On your right is
which is in the Tretyakov Gallery in Moscow.
The choice of Vrubel and Matisse as models tells us something about Gabo's inclinations
from the very beginning of his artistic endeavor.
Inclinations.
At the time, these two artists were considered by Russians to be two of the most advanced painters. Matisse was the most popular and the most emulated Western European artist among the avant-garde, and Vrubel was their
European
artist for the claim that Russia had a native form of
faceted
for the Cubism even before the turn of the century.
In common, they have a colorful luxuriance, an ornamental, abstracted form,
and an elegance which is combined with compositional strength.
And
that stood in marked contrast to some other work, such as Picasso's
proto-cubist
work, which Gabo must have seen also in the private collections
work
at the same time. Gabo's sculpture will eventually present some of the same qualities, a radical style combined with a strong, formal, even classical elegance. Gabo returned to Petrograd in April 1917 by train from Norway, just about the same time that Lenin himself arrived by sealed train through Germany from his exile in Switzerland. Petrograd was
his
turmoil. The Tsar had officially resigned only a month earlier, in the middle of March. And although a provisional government had been installed, it was far from being in control of all sections of the populace. Lenin stirred up further trouble from the very moment of his arrival at Finland's nation by chastising the Bolsheviks for being too conciliatory to the new government and calling for agitation against some of its directives. Soldiers and workers' Soviets formed an alternative governing body,
the
sole powers to ratify or veto orders issued by the provisional government. It was a system of dual power. At the beginning of May, order broke down completely as thousands of soldiers and workers demonstrated in front of the government headquarters against its policies,
against
especially the war, which for almost 3 years had exhausted the resources of
the
country
and had ultimately led
to the revolution itself. A large part of the populace felt the war was imperialist and expressed themselves forcibly in the streets. This is Petrograd in July of 1917. For more than a year, life in Russia had been grindingly difficult. Because of workers' strikes, the factories had all but ceased to function. And by the way, the Pevsner family factory was undoubtedly affected by this. The military situation on the Russian front was disastrous. In Petrograd and Moscow, there was no fuel and little food. Anti-government strikes, and even worse, a debilitating cynicism and despair among the people had brought the railroads and other forms of transportation to a halt. By 1917, the populace was desperate for an end to the war, and it was this that was a primary topic of public debates, impromptu lectures in the streets, and protest demonstrations. The various political organizations vied with one another for popular allegiance. Gabo went back to Bryansk soon after he arrived back in Russia, but in the summer, he moved to Moscow. He was there in November, at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. Ever since summer, tensions in Moscow had been building. An all-out battle raged from the 9th of November to the 16th of November, as the Kremlin was taken by forces sympathetic to the provisional government and retaken by the Red Guards. When the dust cleared, the city was in shambles. So that in 1920, when Gabo began his realistic manifesto, quote, above the tempest of our days, above the ashes and cindered homes of the past, unquote, he was in these lines being quite literal, quite realistic. The revolutions and the civil war that followed introduced new forms into artistic genres. Poems were written in the language of newspapers and military orders, and artists turned to designing a new necessity of daily life,
platforms to lift orators above the heads of the crowd as they were haranguing. This is a Lisitsky design, as they were for a speaker's platform. For the first time in Russia, it became important to communicate directly with the people, to speak to the crowds in the streets, to create a vision of the future in the public mind, to inspire popular opinion to an extent that would lead to civil actions, and to do it where the people were to be found. Platforms had to be erected in the streets. Artists were also called upon to change the look of the country. This is a design for the decoration of Petrograd in 1918 by Nicholas Terza. To provide the populace with images of the new environment, to make a visual change that would reflect the solidity of the new social order and its hope for the future. An entirely new style of public art was born in Russia in the first years of the revolution. Artists decorated towns and cities, boats, trains, and streetcars. This is a decoration for a Moscow street from 1918. And here you see painters decorating a car, propaganda train. One of the first tasks of the new government was to remove all Tsarist public monuments and to replace them with images of new heroes. The new monuments often turned to the latest, most avant-garde styles, in this case to the futurist planar analyses applied to a portrait head, a 20th century style to commemorate a 19th century woman anarchist. This is the memorial to Sofia Perovskaya by Griselli. On a practical level, the old public statues often proved difficult or impossible to remove. And in those cases, they were covered with large concealing wooden structures, which sometimes took on a dual role as speakers' platforms. This one is in Moscow, 1918. Here you see two more of these camouflages. The one on the left is a square in Petrograd in front of the railroad station to Moscow. And the one on the right is in the same location a year later. The left-hand one is 1918 and the right-hand one is 1919. Both of these cover the same statue, which is Trubetskoy's monument to Alexander III. This camouflage itself became an object for new designs. I didn't design the camouflages. This is Krinsky's speaker platform. A modern urban monumental vocabulary based on geometries that were sometimes drawn from earliest cubist art and structures was invented to supplant the academic styles of the old regime. This is Totlin's monument to the Third International on the left, and Vyesnin's drawing for this, for them, also a monument to the Third International. Totlin from 1919 to 20, and Vyesnin from 1920. And Rodchenko's kiosk from 1919. Structures which could neither be disguised or replaced might be changed in some major way. For example, this is the monument to Alexander I by Montferrand, which was erected in 1829. Was made of granite and is the largest monolith in the world. For this column, which is in the center of the square by the Winter Palace, Nathan Altman created a modern disguise for the column in the gigantic square next to the palace. This is his design for the whole palace square. And this is a projected night illumination of the Alexander Column by Altman. All of these are 1918. Another design for the Alexander Column. And here are a group of school children in front of the column. Altman, in fact, had magnified the elements of Totlin's 1915 corner relief. Here you see a reconstruction of this relief by Martin Clark, which was made in 1979 and exhibited in this museum. Altman blew these forms up to gigantic size and covered the base of the monument with them. Other new objects prompted by the revolution were invented by Gabo's friend, Gustav Klutzis. These are entirely new objects. The left is Klutzis' orator, and the right, his projection screen from 1922, both of them. These objects were supposed to be folding collapsible stands that one could carry around and set up on street corners. The object on your right would have a magic lantern in it, which would be projected onto the screen at the top that you see. Showing it on pictures of revolutionary heroes. And this on the left was a record player, basically a portable record player, with records of Lenin's speeches, which could be Lenin played on every street corner as one walked around the city. Now, all of this is very different from what Russian sculpture had looked like previously. Before the momentous political change looked like, avant-garde sculpture was, like painting, political, that is, private, made for individual contemplation, that is, private. Public monuments were by and large the work of academicians. If we look at some sculpture made by the avant-garde before they acquired their semi-architectural public goals, this is on the right, Klune's Musician is from 1916, which is in the Tretyakov. And on the left, a relief by Lyubov Popova from 1915. Relief. 19. Gabo's early constructions of heads, busts, and torsos, such as you see in the instructions of such as this constructed head number 3 of 1917, which is in the Museum of Modern Art. 1917 belongs to work in this tradition, even though the style and material of Gabo's works are innovative, the subject remains a traditional one, the same three-dimensional portrait that had been a subject for sculptors for centuries. For these times, it was really relatively conservative. We might compare it, for example, to Totlin's reliefs from 2 years previously. This is Totlin's relief from 1914, and another view of that reconstruction by Martin Clark. Gabo himself must have been keenly aware of this by the time he had had a chance to orient himself, must have been new surroundings, and to catch up with what had been done in Russia during the war. He had ample opportunity to do this. In 1917, he certainly attended the large Jack of Diamonds exhibition in Moscow in November, and so would have had a good chance to see work by a cross-section of the avant-garde, including Malevich's Suprematism. He hadn't seen it before. And in the next few years, he took an active part in the city's artistic life. And in the next publishing of he took a newspaper of cultural affairs and establishing government collections of the new art for provincial museums. He came to know Totlin, Rodchenko, Klutzis, and the artists of the Moscow Institute of Artistic Culture, the INKUK, including Lyubov Popova, Nadezhda Udaltseva, and Georgi and Vladimir Stenberg. Within about 9 months of his arrival in Moscow, he appears to have stopped working on heads and torsos, and by 1919, he was constructing more abstract reliefs. Here you see a later reconstruction of Gabo's square relief. You see from about, this one is about 1920. Gabo, there are some early relief. Also in 1919, he began a series of towers or columns in 1919. This is an old photograph of a lost Gabo column from 1921, made of bronze and glass. With contemporaneous work, I show you a Rodchenko sculpture from 1918, such as this. They have in common the exploration of the possibilities of industrial materials, of a rejection of natural color, and a kind of technological appearance. This is a student sculpture from the school in Moscow, made by one the Dom School. This is Miedunetsky's construction from 1920. Miedunetsky was part of that Inhuk group. This sculpture is at Yale University Art Gallery right now. And this is Georgi Stienberg's sculpture, also from 1920. Sculpture. Although they functioned independently as small private sculpture, the towers were primarily responsible to Gabo's civic interests and to the notion of expediency, usefulness. This notion was a primary topic of debate between the middle of 1920 and the middle of 1922 at the research-oriented Inhuk. It is related to working out of the role of abstract artists in the new society. The Moscow artists, in talking about utility, were not advocating the old-fashioned notion of applied art or even modern concepts of industrial design. For them, the utility of their constructive works was to be found in the knowledge and the concepts that might be derived from the art. That is, they believed that constructive art, as opposed to easel painting or fine art, is art that in some way functions as a source of information. It might consist of drawings, painting, or three-dimensional constructions, and the results of this work were not necessarily applicable directly to the manufacture of useful objects. The Moscow artists were looking for laws and concepts they hoped would be useful only eventually to those whose business it would be to actually build the new world. For these artists, to be useful was not necessarily to be workable. Here are two views of an exhibition from May 1921 of this kind of constructivist 1920 work that was made to explore the laws of art. And here are two such works by Vladimir Stienberg, sculpture that dates from 1920. The Inhuk artists thought of their work not as an end in itself, but as laboratory work that ultimately contributed to our understanding of the concrete elements of art. Indeed, the constructivists at this time consistently avoided making workable objects. Their models and their fantastic designs that resemble architecture, towers, for example, here, and bridges, were intended to be more explorations of the nature of these structures, of bridgeness or towerness, than proposals for their implementation. In Gabo's studies, we can detect interests that run parallel to the artistic life and interests around him. The exploration, for example, of the shape of kinetic motion seen here on the left in Gabo's study for a tower of 1917, and on the right Tarabukhin's, no, excuse me, that's wrong. I'm sorry. This is Study for Kinetic Construction of 1917, and on the right, Chernyshov's Dynamics of a Structure of about 1920. And here Gabo's study for a tower, also from 1917, and Tarabukhin's static, dynamic, volumetric, composed construction. The study of combinations of curvilinear and planar elements, similar to studies at Innsbruck, which were devoted to analyzing and systematizing the basic elements and forms common to practical structure, basic works of art, can be seen in most of Gabo's structures at this period. This is Gabo's design for a radio station, and is Gabo at his most visionary. In its design, it has much in common with this plan for construction by Gladkov, Exter, and Mukhina from 1923. Simultaneously with exploratory goals, however, Gabo seems to have had the idea that his towers and columns were realistic designs, at least that it would be possible to build them in a larger scale. This design on your left was actually built. Here is a very old, bad photograph of it. So it wasn't all completely fantasy. Totlin, too, hoped to actually build his monument to the Third International. And many of Gabo's designs similarly have about them the sense of real projects. His family background and his experience with engineering make this possibility a natural one. Here's another view of Totlin, a sketch for Totlin's tower, and Gabo's sketch for a square in Moscow from 1919. We hear the echo of the practicality from his engineering background when in 1920, the same year he began to design build towers and columns, he criticized Totlin's monument for its lack of practicality. As Totlin's design, Gabo said, was distinguished by its moving sections. You see, on the work on your right, you can see in the sketch of the three inner sections inside that tilted structure. These are to be extremely large. You have to consider the structure was projected somewhat taller than the Empire State Building. And these inner geometric rooms were to revolve, the lower one once a month, the middle one once a week, and the one at the top once a day. Gabo called them technically out of the question. It will never be built, he said at a meeting called to discuss the problem. Quote, he said, "You don't turn a 6 or 7 or 10 story building to follow the sun," unquote. Like Malevich's sculpture in the 1920s, here you have two views of two of Malevich's architectons, which he called his sculpture at the time. Gabo's work was intended to give a vision of the future, an idea of what the world would look like. Vision of his towers look like this one, less than 5 inches high from 1921, contains within itself a larger monumental scale that is inescapable. We can easily imagine them as buildings. For comparison, I'm showing you Rudnov's designs of 1927. This is Gabo's construction in space from 1921. Gustav Klutz's untitled liner cut from 1922. We can see Gabo's constructions perhaps as part of a large urban ensemble. Yet Gabo never went even as far as his friend Klutz's in depicting the details of a new world. His towers, though containing the seeds of monumentalism, depict the essence rather than the specifics of architecture. The balance, the symmetries, the intersection of planes, and the angled play of positive and negative spaces. You're looking at here a reassembled work from 1924 called Model for Construction in Space with Balance on Two Points. Gabo wrote about this lack of specifics in a manifesto which he printed to accompany his only exhibition that we know of in Russia. In August of 1920, he participated in an exhibition held out of doors in a concert pavilion on the Tversky Boulevard in Moscow. The exhibition was called, quote, The Paintings of Natan Pevsner, The Sculptures of Naum Gabo, and the Pevsner School, and Gustav Klutz's, unquote. In the evenings, an audience gathered, and Gabo read his realistic manifesto, his first statement about his art that we have. This manifesto is clearly the product of his enthusiastic revolutionary beliefs and the concrete political life in Moscow. And this is one reason, I think, that he calls it a realistic manifesto. It calls for an art that will respond to the real laws of life, which he lists as one, actuality, which he calls the highest beauty, two, necessity, the highest and most just of morals, he says, and three, activity or work, which he calls the highest truth. Since, quote, today is our business, unquote, he says, and since we cannot predict the future, art must be constructed so as to reveal essences, that is, relationships. We must make art out of space and time, space given by line and depth, and time as kinetic rhythm. You're looking at here construction in space, two cones on the left, and construction in space soaring on the right. Gabo emigrated to the West. He accompanied the Russian exhibition to Berlin in 1922. But the work that he continued there has never lost its imprint of these revolutionary days in Moscow. His construction in space, two cones, for example, and construction in space soaring right on the right, and which he worked on into the 1930s, echoes and re-echoes with Klutz's orators from 1922. Klutz's double speakers meant to replay the words of Lenin to street corner crowds. Like the other Moscow artists in 1921 and 22, Gabo thought of models not only as pieces of sculpture, they were that too, but as a working out of visual ideas and technical problems which would one day be of general aesthetic value and which might easily inspire and dominate a larger environment, might create a new visual world. One of his first chances to work on a larger scale came in the theater, in the stage set he designed with his brother for La Chatte in 1927. Even though he was no longer in Russia at this time, in this he is moving parallel to his former colleagues in Moscow, who found an outlet for their frustrated architectural visions in the theater. And I'm showing you Lyubov Popova's drawing of a stage set for the Magnanimous Kukult of 1922. In 1947, his Little Moscow Tower from 1920 on your left began to grow. It doubled in size from almost 6 inches to almost a foot, 6 inches. And by 1975, it had reached over 6 feet. His fountain designs in the early 1920s, and here you're looking at two drawings from 1923. And a model from 1924, at last materialized into a real fountain in London in the 1970s.
This is a slightly different fountain. Get the general idea.
And largest of all, the concrete and steel Bischkenkorf construction in Rotterdam, erected in 1957, reaches a height of over 75 feet. I suspect that not even this is the scale that Gabo originally had in mind in the Moscow days. He describes himself as only, quote, one of the hundreds of artists in Moscow possessed by the new vision of a new life, unquote. And he believed that, quote, what we were doing represented the new reality, unquote. What makes him a member of the Russian avant-garde is this deeply internalized revolutionary vision. Art for a changed world, for a world with little but full of hope. This optimism he shared during the time of the revolution with a major portion of the avant-garde. And even though he left Russia, he persisted in these beliefs for decades and exported that vision of art to the West for decades. It was a vision, as we know, that never did materialize. But Gabo's work remains as its
never
firm
did materialize.
Gabo as its firm testimony.